to lead until all things that it leads return to the divine substance from which they came. Life cannot be defeated, but minds can prevent or slow down the processes of life. Wrong actions can definitely weaken the progress which we also definitely desire to make. So the mandala becomes again another type of symbolism for us. It is the picture of the thing that it, as it ought to be, and as the power of life has decreed that it shall be. It is a picture of the achievement of which we are all capable, but which for the most part we do not appreciate or understand. So inside we find a kind of beautiful diagram, balanced figure, no bumps or lumps on it, no flames of hell, nothing to disfigure it. A magnificent unfolding of a vast flower like the bud of the lotus. An unfolding that reveals the universe upon the petals of an eternal flower. It is like Dante's famous vision in the Divine Comedy, in which he beholds all the hierarchies of angels standing together singing upon the petals of the divine rose. All of these symbols show that behind and within us, all of us, lie the solutions to everything that disturbs us. We are worried. There's an answer. We are frightened. There's a cure. We are sad. There is peace. We want to do better. Growth is natural to us. Anything that fulfills the divine plan is available to us to the degree that we can use it. And as we use it wisely, we become rulers or guardians over more and larger things. But actually, the entire situation is one in which a gentle understanding leads to a kind of meditation. Now, in the Orient, the disciples with the mandalas sit very quietly and look at these pictures. And they see in these pictures their own personal lives plus this little monk who's just a child of 14 has come from a poor home. His family has always worked very hard. He has a life probably before him of labor, for in many instances monastic orders are only 2 or 3 years in the life of the person. Then he returns to his own world to do the things he has to do. It is regarded as more important that unless he has some very strong spiritual gift, that he returns after proper initiation to the responsibilities of the layman and the family and the home and the country. He is not supposed simply to sit for the rest of his life praying for his own spiritual development. He is supposed to be out serving, forgetting self, and in the forgetting of self, becoming aware of God. In this particular case, he is seated, however, studying this pattern, the pattern which to him is a dream, something that as he looks upon it, his own inner life comes out. Pythagoras, the Neoplatonists, made a great point of beauty. They made a point of the fact that the beauty in the human soul is due to the fact that the soul is a symmetrical geometric solid. It is a perfect imagery, a magnificent symmetrical crystal-like thing, in all things beautiful. And looking out from the beauty within, the individual gradually becomes aware of this inner beauty through its outer shadows in the world of physical things. Looking at his picture of in meditation, the young monk, therefore, sees the walls open, sees the sky come through, and suddenly finds himself quietly sitting in the midst of an infinite peace, a peace that is for everything and in everything, gentle, kind, and sublime. He knows, of course, that he cannot hold this attitude. He knows that only through the moment in which he becomes suddenly enlightened, like Behme, the German mystic, was enlightened by looking at a pewter plate, that he will see something, and then gradually it will close again, and the monk will be back in the world where he came from. But in this journey, he has discovered something. He has become aware that infinite beauty is only a condition of an unconditioned reality, that it is one of the wonderful things that make up the great wonder, one of the beautiful things that make up the eternal beauty of life. And so with this type of thinking, we can start to revise and redesign the pictures of our own existence. We can begin to recognize that there is much too much suffering that is never called for. The greatest of all suffering is not to see that which is beyond and above suffering. It is the individual focusing upon the uncertainties rather than striving to attain to the certainties. Plotinus, the great Neoplatonist philosopher, said that only on two or three occasions during his life, for an instant or two, did he behold the mystery of life. Did he actually see the infinite as a vast explosion of light, a tremendous infinite beauty, and this beauty extending from the begun to the beyond, this which had no boundaries, no limitations, but ineffable stupendous reality. Only for a few instants did he become aware of this great mandala, the universe itself, as one luminous reality in which all things were fulfilled and perfected by infinite love. This discovery to him was only for an instant, but it became the basis of his life. Havelock Ellis had a somewhat less intense but mystical experience. It only happened once, but he was never the same again. And the moment the eyes within ourselves open even far enough to have a glimpse of the realities, the moment that happens, illusion begins to lose power. The delusions of material existence retire into what they actually are, experiences to be faced and passed, weaknesses to be strengthened, ignorance to be enlightenment, fears to be transformed into eternal hope. All these are pictures within us, and these pictures are the things that make it possible for us to dream the better dream. Now, in our daily thinking and life and working, we all have some textbooks, we all have some pictures that are important. Many of us have living pictures around us that become very wonderful and very meaningful. So with our studies and with our striving after righteousness, so to say, there should be this meditation on the mandala. There should be constantly in mind the perfect picture. We may not be able to attain it immediately, but we can improve it to a very large degree with a little thought and kindness. But everywhere the wonders are. Some people like to go out into the country and to sit under a tree. Others prefer to take long voyages on the ocean. Some want the country, some prefer the city. But everyone is looking for the fulfillment of some need within himself. And most of these needs, as in the case of Thoreau, gradually lead to the countryside, to the nature of things. And the final pattern comes up in the concept of the conflict between the artificial and the natural. In the world of men, most of our policies and patterns are artificial. They are things we have created in various ways as patches upon previous mistakes. We are constantly surrounded by a finite world of our own making, a world in which we are struggling to do something and we do not know how, a world in which the best and most ambitious achievements fall apart, a world that fails because it has not any foundation in love. It is founded in skills and in science and profit and in wealth, but not in that gentle, kindly love in which the individual comes close to the world of truth. There is a fable in China that Lao Tzu, the famous sage, the obscure sage, the Tao Te King was probably one of the most mysterious books ever written. This great mystic, who actually left Confucius in a state of internal confusion, Lao Tzu, was born as a servant on the estate of a wealthy man. He had no education in the ordinary sense of the word, but being a thoughtful person in his own right, this little child sat on the side of a hill and looked out over the mountains, over the five great peaks of eternity that bounded China. He sat there quietly, allowing life and nature to move in upon him. And there, in the absolute tranquility of a little boy in a big world, and finding this big world just as sweet and close and wonderful as the nearest parent could have been, this little boy suddenly discovered that nature was a great mother, taking care of all creatures with infinite tenderness. On he went into life, went into a series of experiences which are summarized in the world of Dao. This experience was the cancellation, so to say, of all of the rationalizations by which we strive to explain away our own mistakes. Lao Tzu said the only way to explain away a mistake is to stop it, is not to do it anymore. All of the mind with its problems, its worries, its burdens should be allowed to rest. And it rests best on the side of a hill. Thoreau found the same thing in the Pool of Walden. It's best to find peace in the source of peace, the great mandala of nature. Here, under a tree and alongside of some brook in the forest or wilderness, the individual suddenly becomes aware that he is part of something, and that this something that he's part of is greater than he can ever be. But he can know it and experience it and be grateful for it and share in it, and he'll do everything possible to help to protect it against the ravages of ignorance, superstition, and fear. So the peace of the realization of nature was very strong with nearly all the philosophers and nearly all of the great systems. And the mountains and the valleys and the hills and the seas, these are also, as Lao Tzu pointed out, a great diagram, a great symbolism, a tremendous set of hexagrams by means of which every principle in the universe could be reduced to a mathematical equation. And yet in mathematics was as gracious, loving, and kind as was the original in nature. They believe definitely that mathematics is not a sterile mental exercise. It is merely a way of worshiping through the revelations of truth, reality, and accuracy. Always to do that which is necessary for the greater good. And the trigrams, the diagrams, are very, very important to us. Lao Tzu tells us that life is a river. The river pours down into the sea. The individual returns to the infinite. The sun shines upon the sea, and the water is raised. And the water goes up and falls upon the mountains. And the mountains drain it down through little streams until it joins the river again, and the river again returns to the sea. This is life. There is this endless cycling, nothing lost, nothing added, nothing subtracted. Life fulfilling a great cyclic motion, a motion leading from the infinite back again to the infinite. And that in this motion, as the Chinese artist shows it, in this motion, man is a little figure on a great landscape. He is also a little gentleman sitting in a small boat in the midst of the ocean. This is considered to be an appropriate symbol of the wayfarer. the individual is on his way. Not too long ago, Chinese art expert noticed one of these paintings that showed the little man fishing. And to his amazement, he discovered that there was a fishing reel on the pole, which we thought we had invented much, much later. There's no picture, however, in any of the Burkes of this man ever catching anything. He is fishing, but in the substance, he has no bait and he has no hook. So the man who fishes without a hook became the symbol of the Taoist philosopher, who is forever searching for the life that is in the midst of the ocean, but has no attempting or not trying to capture it or destroy it or possess it himself. All these things are little sidelights upon a very interesting subject. But most of all, I think that the real answer is that each one of us can take our own lives from childhood up to now, and we can examine it in terms of a great symbol, one symbolic picture unfolding down through the years of our days. We're coming down through all of the experiences of life, from childhood, from school, from marriage, from parenthood, business, age, retirement, grandchildren, all kinds of activities. They're all part of a great picture. Now, if we can follow this picture correctly, I think we will find out something that is being considered very seriously now by some of our very best scientific institutions. That if we can take this period from birth to retirement, and we can do it without breaking rules, without destroying our own vitalities, without wrecking our own happiness by actual actions that are unnecessary. If we can live this span with peace and in peace, and can live it in service and love and friendship, that we will discover that in this process alone, we will have defeated most of the hazards of physical existence. We will find that this type of living is a healing of the wounds of the flesh, that a great deal of our mental and physical suffering is simply due to the unfinished business we refuse to face, that we can go through the span of life quietly, comfortably, and peacefully, we will also, in due time, pass into a larger life, quietly and peacefully. We will not sicken the body before its time. A great deal of suffering is due to the fact that one factor of our disposition, which is wrong, is beating down one organ of the body with which it is associated. The rest of the body is violently struggling to succeed. But one dispositional trait that refuses to be corrected, or we do not correct, can bring the whole body down in ruin. Thus it is for importance. Peace of mind is health of body. Peace of mind and health of body result in the clarity of the soul, its ability to fulfill its preachment to us through the eternal example of universal friendship, affection, and understanding. I think then, therefore, that we are all out looking for panaceas. We are all looking desperately to something to cure the ills with which we suffer. We are trying to figure out why our lives are plagued with one uncertainty or another. It is not quite that bad. Lao Tzu found out long ago that no matter what we do, life is eternal. We will continue going along, doing the best we can, until we do better. And when we really do what is better, a great mass of sorrow, disturbances fall away. Our world today, fighting as it is, half the rest of itself, a world constantly in fear of enemies, has never realized that the only reason that it has enemies is that it has forgotten to make friends. It has forgotten to do those things which bring people together. It has emphasized competition. It has made much of divisions and disturbances, but it has not found the healing power of universal soul growth, the power within the individual. So in the Shingon symbolism, the final achievement is that the individual, in a sense, gets up and walks into the mandala and disappears in it. That may not actually happen. He may still be sitting there, but some part of him has gone into the painting. The Taoist monks drew a picture of a door leading from this world to the next. He sat meditating upon the picture for a number of years, then got up, opened the door he had painted, and went through and disappeared. A nice fable, but there's a principle back of it. We can go through any door that we paint and before which we sit in quiet study long enough. But the door we're all trying to go through is the one that leads into a larger life, into a greater happiness, a greater security, a greater peace and understanding. We know now, as we watch the gradual closing of the 20th century, that this is a mandala also. This scene, the world scene today, is a great picture, a great painting, a great and mysterious mass of interrelated symbols that we must accept and view as we best we can. This is a great dramatic text. We are looking at the symbol of unfinished business. We are looking at a condition that is inevitable until it is cured by that which causes it. We realize there can be no peace in this world until the human being finds peace in his own heart. There is no way of making a better world until we inwardly visualize the reorganization of divided parts and put them together into one sublime pattern. In the meantime, we go on our way and we have troubles and we get into financial difficulties and we get a little more money than somebody else and waste it more quickly than they do. All these things, we have a little life which is rounded by a sleep. We have a little way of doing things that we consider to be tremendously important. We are just little people in a great big mystery, and each one of us wants to have a little private world of our own in which we can do as we please. It can't be done that way, because no combination can be brought together on the physical side of itself. Bodies can never mingle, but spirits can unite. We can never get over the divisions of society until our hearts and minds become undivided in a unity of life and truth. Everything you can look at or think of, make a symbol out of it. Make it as might have been in one of the symbol writers of the 17th century. Alciot's emblems is a good example. Here we have all kinds of moral pictures, pictures with little verses and poems added to them, but most of all the picture. Quarrel was an English emblem writer who has a very delightful little book suitable to children, written back in the 17th century. One of his symbols shows a cage, a bird cage, and in the bird cage is the soul imprisoned. And outside of the bird cage is the lover trying to find a way to open the cage. And this is what it amounts to. This is the problem we have, that we have imprisoned the best and locked it in by refusing to permit ourselves to be turned from our selfishness by any intuition of something better. We want to go our own way, so we go and suffer. But if we go the way of the inner life, we will not go on suffering, but will be better. And we do not have to get this key to the inner life from any other source than the inward part of ourselves. We cannot simply read ourselves into salvation We can learn things, and some of them will be very useful. But actually, the great decisions all have to be made within ourselves. And our particular ray of light, that which can make things right for us, must come from ourselves. It was given to us in the beginning. It has been with us through unnumbered embodiments, through all kinds of experiences. It has continued and will continue until we make use of it. In some of the Indian fables that we occasionally see, there is great emphasis upon observation. The individual, in order to learn, must note things that happen. The moment an unexpected or unusual occurrence comes along, it should be thought about. If it's good, it shouldn't be just accepted with a note of gratitude and people go right on the way they were. If it was an unpleasant experience, it should not be regarded as misfortune. It should be regarded as challenge, as need, something arising that we must think about. But all around us, every day, things happen. We don't like some of the things that happen. We are the victims of criminal action. We are victims of cupidity, selfishness, indifference. We are often betrayed in our deepest and most sacred emotions. And yet we have to go on. The answer is that each one of these things has to be remedied. All ills that come to us are sort of diseases. They are psychic ailments that sometimes are contagious, pass from generation to generation. In other cases, they are plagues that hit us all at once. But every one of these occurrences has to be redeemed, has to be regenerated. The mistake must be solved. The pain must be remedied. And the individual must rise quietly above disappointments that would otherwise change and embitter him. The false interpretation of experience leads to a very embittered life. The person goes on through the years more and more suffering, more and more hurt, more and more antisocial. Many people, in those years of life which are most important, when they must live quietly with themselves, have so built a psychological structure of embitteredness that they cannot even enjoy the peace of a pleasant and financially secure retirement. They are still suffering from the ills that have been done to them. They are still revengeful about things of their earlier life. This is a great mistake. If there's one thing that is immediately a reward for putting your life in order, it is the fact that you can live with yourself happily after you've retired from business. That you can actually be pleasantly interested in life. That while maybe the faculties get a little tired and there are limitations upon what we can do, if we have the right inner life, we will always be cheerful. We will always be grateful for the good things that happen. We will continue to shed an atmosphere of joy around us wherever we go. But most of all, we can live with ourselves. And as we live more and more with ourselves, we will discover that a large part of sickness is dispositional, that we are in trouble most of the time simply because we do not have the grace to forgive our enemies or recognize our friends. So all along the way, the inner life can bring with it extension of years. It can bring with it a great fulfillment. It can allow us to depart from this little cycle of activity with a sincere realization that we have been of service to others, that we have helped to build a little bit better world, that we have fulfilled our dreams by making dreams that were worth fulfilling. The locked-in materialist has most difficulty of all. In the Indian system, Zavichi is the material world. It is the world of physical things. And in the Platonic dialogues, so-called Hades, is the same thing. Plato said, we do not go to Hades when we die. We come to Hades when we are born. This is it. So we must realize that we are in a world in which a very large part of the population is paying debts and therefore is very anxious, more or less, to bring others into the same miseries that it has itself. We are in a world of shadows, as Plato pointed out. We are in the world in which we must live with the consequences of our own deeds and attitudes. This is the secret behind the concepts of heaven and hell. Heaven is to live with a redeemed self. Hell is to live with one that isn't doing so well. And there are a good many of them. But the whole problem is very definitely that the evolutionary cycle is one in which cause and effect work together. The individual who makes mistakes and doesn't try to correct them is in trouble right here and takes the unfinished business with him. It's been my responsibility on a number of occasions to be with people in the hour of transition. And it is very interesting to observe that in those hours, in those last minutes, a great many tangled situations untangle themselves. And the individual who is fighting all the way to continue as manager of the banks suddenly loses all interest in it. He's going where that doesn't mean anything anymore. He's going where he can't take his pocketbook, which is a very serious disaster. He's going where he can't continue to take care of his children. He suddenly realizes that he's been so busy doing other things that he has lost most of the joy of his own private life. He knows also that he is in pain, and that this pain is something that more or less is in harmony with the fact that he has never done anything to cause anything but pain. He has never done those things which would have brought peace to him in his early days and might well have extended his life. One man in his 40s passing on wished he could live it over, because he says if he could, he would be a much better person and would have better values and would not regard material success as worth one moment of compromise of personal integrity. So we don't sometimes go out of this world wiser than when we enter. This is fortunate. This is a desirable state of affairs. Because it's what we go out with may well be what we come back with. And the individual who has discovered more of the real values of existence, who has realized where the truths and where the great achievements are located, and begun to cast off those useless things and become aware of eternal truths. We are here, and we all come out in the end a little wiser. And we might as well realize as we go along that this little wiser can start right now. And therefore, that before our complete patterns are finished for this life, we can have a great span of wonderful living now, in which we see ourselves correcting our own faults and lay the foundations of the future. And realize that in this plan of things, it is a blessed truth that we shall all have the opportunity to perfect our own futures. It will come. Nothing can prevent it from happening. In due time, everything we should have will be ours. And each time we come back, we will bring with us a little more insight, a little greater patience, a little deeper understanding. This makes it all very, very well worthwhile. And it also is the one great justification for behaving ourselves. It is the justification of deserving something better. And if we deserve something better, we'll get it. And we can start deserving it right now, and it might result in a sorrow that we might have faced will never happen, simply because we are no longer the person to whom it was intended to happen. The Japanese artist, Hokusai, one of the great engravers of Japan, changed his name a great number of times in the course of his career. And one of the reasons he changed his name was that he wanted to live longer. Now, this doesn't seem as though it has a pertinent relationship with the subject, but it does. Because every time he changed his name, he confused Emma-A, the Lord of the Other Life. When he was Katsumato, why the God of Death had that name on his book. But if the artist changed his name, it confused the God of Death. He didn't have that name on his book. Therefore, he didn't call for him that soon. And with these meager changes, Hokusai managed to live to a very great age. But finally, of course, they found out his true name. And it was all right because the God of the underworld, or the afterlife, employed him immediately to paint new screens for his palace. And Hokusai had a place of distinction in the realms of the afterlife. And being a Buddhist, he undoubtedly believed he'd be back. So all these things make little pictures. And if you put a whole group of nice, gentle, pleasant, kindly little pictures together, we all of a sudden have another life, a life that is better than one that is filled with the memory of odd things that were not pleasant. So let's build as much as we can upon happy things, upon the wonderful privileges and opportunities that have come to us, and not depend too heavily upon regrets. Let us cease forever believing that we are misjudged and mistreated. The only way we can really be mistreated is when we mistreat ourselves. Others may try to do it, but if we are right, they can't do a thing about it. It's only when we agree with them that we are being mistreated that the trouble starts. Each person can solve it for himself. And all these pictures have something to do with this idea. A wonderful pattern, a wonderful picture, and finally our own lives. And in the end, each one of us will have a kind of picture that may remind us a little bit of a great rose window of a cathedral. It will be a beautiful picture of light in which all the dreams that we've ever had will come true. Well, thank you very much, folks. That's all for this morning.